Welcome to another episode of GEQ Speaks, your go-to platform for insightful conversations, captivating stories, and thought-provoking discussions. GEQ is a series of experiences, and we're just making sense of that as we go along. That is what we're doing here, one conversation at a time. So sit back, relax, and let's dive into our episode.
Hello everyone, this is Abdullah bin Masood. I would like to welcome you all to another episode of GEQ Speaks. Now, over the past few months, a lot of students have reached out to us asking to dedicate an episode to student research opportunities available at Georgetown. So by popular demand, I bring you this episode based on student research opportunities. And along with myself, we have two very special guests joining us today. Our first guest is MK Herb. MK is a GUQ alumni. He graduated from Georgetown in 2014, after which he went to Harvard to complete his master's in Near and Middle Eastern Studies. MK has an enduring passion when it comes to research and has published a number of fictional and non-fictional texts in various journals. He joined Georgetown Qatar in 2019 as a member of the staff and was the former assistant director of admissions. Quite recently, he has been appointed as the assistant director for student research, overseeing all student research-related activities. Thank you, MK, for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me, Abdullah. I'm excited for the podcast.
Our next guest is Asma Shakil, a very dear friend and a senior belonging from the class of 2024. Asma has previously conducted research on the impact of lockdown on migrant workers in India as a Lisa J. Raines Fellow at Georgetown, and has served as a research and policy intern for the Middle East Council on Global Affairs. She's also worked as a publication assistant for Georgetown Center for International and Regional Studies, where she's assisting with the forthcoming book, Global Histories of Islamophobia. Most notably, she is the recipient of the prestigious 2024 Rhodes Scholarship, the third Hoya to win the oldest and most competitive international scholarship this year. This scholarship will allow her to pursue her master's in global and imperial history and a PhD in history at the University of Oxford, where she hopes to use archives from British missionaries in South Asia to better understand the history of her homeland, Kashmir. Asma, we're delighted to have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much, Abdullah. That's quite a bit of a chunky introduction, but I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me. Yeah.
Okay, so my first question is to you, MK. I want to understand the importance of engaging in research work, especially when you come as a freshman to pursue your undergraduate degree. I've noticed that a lot of people don't know what are the different avenues for research, how to immerse themselves in this journey of research, and they're not even aware of the benefits, the tangible outcomes that it has in terms of both skill set development and practical benefits it has in terms of after your journey after undergrad and pursuing a graduate degree and everything. Mm-hmm. So could you please elaborate on the benefits and the importance research work has?
So that's a really good question. Before we get to the tangible benefits or some of the more long-term benefits, let's say graduate school or editorial work, I would say the first real kind of tangible benefit is the self-development that comes with research. It's an intellectual pursuit. So there's a lot of self-growth, intellectual growth. I recall being a first-year student at Georgetown and then doing my honors thesis in my senior year. It was like being two different people. Mm-hmm. So the research I got during that time as a student with the hands-on experience, the relationship with my professor, the passion for the literature itself and the resources I was encountering, the fieldwork in Beirut in particular, made graduate school actually easier and more interesting because I had arrived with this new kind of research mentality. Now, first, let's talk about what do we mean by research. It's a bit of a general term sometimes. Part of this practice is to clarify it more, particularly for first-year students. I know they come a lot with this question to my office every now and then on what does it mean. I think a good place to start is to think about first your experience in class, especially if you're a first-year student. So let's say you're writing a paper or you're engaging with a book review or a literature review, or even you're stimulated by certain discussions with your professors or your peers in a classroom, and you have this aha moment like, oh, actually, this is a topic I'm much more interested in broadening my knowledge of. This is kind of like the first seed for a research idea. And then you kind of have to see how you want to pursue that, whether it's through furthering kind of like the primary resource analysis, data analysis, literature review, traveling for field work, talking with your professor. First, I would recommend for the students to come and talk to us, like on the student research office side. I'm using the plural us, but it's just me right now. but first, to kind of clarify what avenues they go under and student research. So I'll talk about the funding opportunities later.
Yeah.
But having that conversation is important because are they first engaging in a traditional research, like in a sense where they're going to produce a manuscript that's more like a capstone project, like or an expanded paper, or are they doing creative research? So some students might be interested in following the same methods of looking at resources, doing fieldwork, even doing interviews, but the output might not look like a written, a traditional written paper, an academic paper. It might look more like an editorial piece or an op-ed. Or a magazine article, or it might even look like a short film or a documentary. It really depends. So these all fall under the umbrella term of research. Now, of course, at Georgetown, we're lucky that we have some of the best faculty that can kind of guide you with the traditional research. And some of our faculty also incorporate creative pursuits. I'm sure you know that with this with the GQ Speaks Club as well. But I'd like to emphasize the part for grad school, which you mentioned in the beginning of the question. It's, I think, tantamount for grad school in a sense where if you take that effort to go beyond just your papers and engage, let's say, apply for a grant at Georgetown to engage in more research, if you do an honors thesis, which is a very intensive, and Asma can talk about her experience later, intensive form of research, almost comparable to a master's degree in certain instances, you're going to have a really beautiful sample to showcase later on to a graduate school office, to professors who you might reach out to. In grad school, a lot of grad school connections happen through the faculty there instead of just traditionally through the admissions office. Of course, you have to go through that process. Yeah. But if you have a sample to showcase, like, hey, in my 4 years, I actually went above and beyond and produced this research X or this research X beyond just what my professors had required of me, it will definitely give you a push and put you in a different pool when you're being considered for a master's or PhD later on.
Perfect. Thank you so much for that, MK, especially for highlighting what research entails in the first place, because a lot of people don't really know that. A lot of people aren't sure about the creative element of research, especially when I was a freshman. I always thought of writing papers, lengthy papers that are boring. But
they're not always boring. Sometimes they're actually fun. But
exactly. So thank you for that. Expanding on this, expanding on the fact that there's this drive for research, I want to ask Asma about your passion for research. Can you walk us through your journey here at Georgetown so far in terms of research? Did you always have this passion, or was it something you discovered when you came here as a freshman, or how did it come about?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I think it'll allow me to make it more personal and not speak for everyone when we talk about research. So when I came to Georgetown, I did not think that I would major in international history. I came here to do international politics because it was SFS. But I remember taking my pro seminar class with Professor Walther, and it was a very interesting class where we discussed a lot of political debates through creative mediums like films, comic books. And it helped me realize that politics and history, they are not aloof from creative world. And that was my first instinct to understand that I think history is where I see myself. Because traditionally, I thought history is a very boring subject. All you have to do is like memorize dates and treaties. And the fun part is in the present. But later on, I realized that the present is only fun because of what happened in the past or vice versa. So that's where I started to think of history as a major I wanted to take up. And I think it was in my sophomore year that I saw a mail come up in one of my many mailboxes by from Center for Research and Fellowship undergraduate department at main campus. And it's an email that I think everybody received. And they were looking for a research assistant under Georgetown's undergraduate research opportunity. It's called GUROP. It's very famous now, but back when I first heard about it, nobody knew. And it was a research opportunity to work under Professor Nagwan Suleiman. She works at the Talal Center of Middle East on main campus. And they wanted somebody who was interested in Middle East history, democratization in Middle East generally. Now, on my first instinct, I thought, like, I have no research experience. I had never worked as an RA, and I was just a sophomore, so I thought I should not apply. But on the second thought, I realized that I had taken 4 classes on Middle East. I was positioned at a campus that was more fruitful to talk about Middle East in a way that main campus would never be able to. And I realized that I had come across a lot of literature work on famous Middle Eastern scholars. I had taken a very rigorous elective by Professor Aryan on Arab uprisings and a history of Arab uprisings. And it was the research position wanted to work around democratization after the Arab uprising. So when I submitted my CV, it did not have a single research background. All I submitted on my CV was just the classes I had taken, the passion that I had taken from those classes, and why I was interested in working on this topic. And to my surprise, they asked me to sit for an interview with her. And in the interview, she asked me about the books that I had read, and it flew like a very genuine and natural conversation. And afterwards, I got the position. It was, of course, remote and it was unpaid. And I was an undergraduate just looking to develop my CV. So that's one thing you should think about. Like when you're starting out, you need to take up opportunities which might not be as beneficial. They might not give you enough pay, or they might not give you some privileges that later on you might get. But it's important to have that one breakthrough. And I think that position was my breakthrough. And from there onwards, I realized that I really like speaking about books, or reading books and then making two books converse with one another. And it's at that point afterwards that I realized that research is not something that is very tough, or it has to be hard. Research is just something we do on everyday basis. For example, if you need to buy an outfit or a shirt or in headphones, you would go on the internet and try to get as much information as you can about these headphones, right? And you would want to compare these headphones with other brands of headphones to figure out which one has the best audio sound quality, which one is the cheapest and fits my budget. And that's the research you do to even buy a simple product like a headphone. And that's exactly what I was doing for my projects and for our classes. We try to find out a project we're interested in, and we have a question that we want to answer. Now, this is something I think most people fail to figure out. Every time somebody asks me that they want to do research, but they don't know if they have enough knowledge to embark on this project, I tell them that that's the point that you should realize you want to do research, because you don't need an answer. Definitely. You just need a question to find an answer to. And from there onwards, I think my friend and a fellow Hoya senior, Huda, she found out about this fellowship like that you mentioned in the introduction, Lisa J. Rain's fellowship. And it had a theme. It was, of course, a fellowship based out of DC. But on the form, it didn't say that GUQ students were not eligible. So we just sent out an email to them. Is it possible that we can apply? And they said, of course, we are more than welcome to make an application. And the theme for this, for the research fellowship, was global migration challenges. And we were thinking about migration. And Huda is an econ major and I'm a history student. And normally you would think that these two majors have nothing in common.
Yeah.
But both Huda and I embarked on this project together. It was a project detailing the oral histories of migration exodus and thinking about the policy and economic packages post COVID-19 migration exodus in India. And when we got we of course didn't think that we would get the grant, but we were sure that this project had become so interesting to us from the get-go that we would still go on and conduct our field work over the summer. So Huda and I, of course, were privileged enough to get the grant, and we went to Delhi, and it was a place we have always been. We grew up in some areas of Delhi, so it was something that we were not like new to, but we were new to the research experience of it. And over the summer, we spent 3 weeks conducting 24 interviews of migrant workers. And originally, we were thinking that we would just create an oral history archives project out of it so that other scholars can pick up from it. But later on down the project, we realized that some things that we might know of, other scholars might not know because of their positionality. Yeah. And we decided to write about it, and we eventually wrote a 9,000 word essay about it, which of course we have not published. So I think that's one thing that people think about, like if you do research, you have to get a publication. We are very early on at this stage. I think at 20, 24, it's not important to have publications. In fact, many professors at Georgetown did not have a publication until after they did their PhD. So I think that's something we think about, and it deters us from going to research. You don't have to get any publication. Yeah. From thereafter, I think I began thinking about more historical kinds of methodologies to do my research. And then in my junior year, I thought, like, now that I have this this thing on my CV, I'm more credible to apply for a more rigorous, competitive grant. And that's when I applied for the Provost's Undergraduate Research Fellowship. And my idea was simple, that I wanted to use this fellowship to get enough money to probably go to the archives in the UK, which I would use for my research, for my thesis. So Provost, during this fellowship, once I received it, I did not write anything. I just spent my summer in the archives and collected as much data as I can. So basically, if you think of it, research can also just be data collection. You do not have to produce anything. You can just take that data and keep it to yourself as well. You do not have to produce an output right away. You're not a tenure track professor who is on a deadline to produce a manuscript. You're just students. And this can, as MK you said, just be an intellectual pursuit. Yeah. So I think that is from where I started. I am not a person who comes from a background of academics in the family. Nobody in my family has been an academic, so it wasn't something that was fed to me. I discovered it over the years.
Yeah. No, that's very interesting to hear about your journey, how you discovered it, and how Georgetown actually aided you in this journey and helped you along the way. And it's very inspirational for all those people who come in as freshmen and have no idea what to do. As you said, you came here knowing that you'll be doing politics and then shifted to history. We'll come more on your major. We'll talk more about your major later. But now, moving to you, MK, I wanted to ask that someone who is looking to immerse themselves in this research journey, let's say a freshman or a sophomore, what avenues are there available for this person at Georgetown, and how does Georgetown aid and help this person in researching about any topic that they're interested about?
Mm-hmm. That's an important question, because kind of like we talked about right now, it's important to identify the research part, but then what's step two in terms of the funding? I do want to comment that Asma made a really important point, that sometimes we do these positions that might not be paid or might not look coveted, but actually they unlock a world of opportunities, either intellectually or through the network, you mean. One of the editor jobs I held years ago was a remote, unpaid job, and I even did it as an adult. So sometimes you make these decisions, and I think that job in particular took my publishing next level. So it's a give or take. In terms of the opportunities available to students, so right now we have three avenues. We can talk about the main campus stuff a bit later, but let's focus on the GEQ part right now. So we have a fund for GEQ student research. Okay. That one is basically a proposal that a student submits. And they can come to us ahead of time to discuss the proposal, and they can also go to the Writing Center, which I always recommend to kind of look at it after. But basically, that proposal is to expand on a research idea you have. So you can be in any of the majors. It could be an idea you have for summer. So let's say you're a student X who is interested in studying this topic historically or through an econ kind of lens through data analysis or more IPOL, or you're even interested in traveling for field work. You apply through a standard form that we have on our website called the Student Research Grant, and basically write a proposal. In the proposal, it's important to outline, A, why you're interested in this intellectually, B, what are the long-term goals, what's coming out of it? Is this a capstone project? Is this something that's part of your fieldwork for your honors thesis? So Asma did a fellowship, the Provost Fellowship, but like now students can also apply for through the student research to do fieldwork for their honors thesis, let's say. It can be a totally independent project that you're engaging in, because you're not falling, not everyone falls under the honors or the certificate category. Some students might just be interested in independent research. This is also an avenue for you to have a work to kind of showcase for yourself before you graduate, if you're not interested in the honors path, which might be a lengthy commitment for some. I do have to indicate it doesn't have to be over the summer. Students tend to prefer summer because it gives them that breathing time, but it can be in fall or spring. With the proposal where you outline these goals, where you outline a timeline, I always say this, more specific it is, the higher the chance you're going to get the grant. The more general it is, the more general the chance you're getting the grant. So try to be as specific as possible in terms of measuring your goals. And then there's a budget that's attached. And that budget, I'll just briefly say what it can cover.
Sure.
Transport, that can mean like actually traveling to country X that you're going to and back in terms of the flight costs, internal transport in the country, hotels in certain cases, if there's room left, sometimes meals as well. And also some students doing fieldwork sometimes opt to have an honorarium for the people they're interviewing, especially if they're in precarious situations, as kind of like a symbolic gesture. So it really depends. So that's one of the avenues. It's a, as I said, it's a standard form. You are required to put a faculty member's name, but they're not required to write a letter for that one. It's basically kind of like a vouching for you in case we need to reach out for someone. And then it goes through a committee review, and the student hears back in a few weeks. In this form as well, there's another opportunity, which is important, is the travel to conferences. So let's say you're in trajectory B. You've done this independent research, or you have this stellar paper, you've been accepted to a conference, you're eligible to apply under the student research grant for something called the conference grant. So this year we've had students go to the main campus to present some papers related to urbanism and city studies. We've had students go to Austria to discuss disability activism. The main conditions for these are either being accepted to present a paper or B, being invited to a more high-level conference, so let's say something like COP, to participate. However, the fund can't be used just to attend a conference. Again, even with the conference proposals, in a way, they're also part of your research goals, so you shouldn't see them as separate. So the effort that's put into the proposal should also be like well thought out, specific, kind of outlining why am I attending this conference? Is it helping me with my academic network? Is it helping me connect with peers who are interested or professors that inspire me in my field of studies that I want to meet in person? Will this conference or an encounter maybe make me think about a certain PhD path or master's path? So those are the two main ones. Their third one, which is the Student Experience Fund, can cover creative research and a wide range of things. I do want to make this distinction, though, because I think it's important for the students. You can't apply with the traditional research prompt and the Student Experience Fund. What you can apply for is creative research. So let's say you have a documentary you want to shoot. Let's say you're producing a zine or something along those lines. You can apply for creative outputs of research, but not a paper, let's say, I'm addressing this policy X. That can't be funded under the Student Experience Fund because it's already funded in a separate category. Now, that fund also covers summer courses, especially if they're related to your field of work or your own development. So let's say this summer course will unlock a credit that will help with the certificate or with this minor or with this fulfillment of a capstone project. So it has to have these ties. Even if it's a summer course, I always recommend put the effort in the proposal. See the summer course as part of your wider research pursuit. You know, not just I'm applying to do the summer course. I'm applying because this summer course fits into this intellectual timeline that's helping me achieve this goal. I really love it when I see a proposal from a student that shows like, okay, this summer course is helping me with my major, and this help with my major is also helping with my timeline towards grad school or employment. Not everyone wants to go to grad school. So have these intuitive connections. It really helps, especially when your proposal is being read by a committee. That's something I like highlighting to students, is that keep in mind Georgetown generally follows a holistic review overall, and there's committee members who are different. Each one kind of grades in their own way, you know. So try to remember that not one person is reading these proposals, you know. So these are kind of the main three places right now students can start with. I can say so far we've had students go to conferences, as I mentioned, apply for research grants related to the environment for the summer, and they've been successful, which involves travel for field work as well. We've had students also apply for documentaries that will happen over the summer. So we're really excited to see this kind of world expand right now, also beyond what we mean of traditional research. One thing I would highlight is if you're successful in a grant, like in student research grant, and let's say you have this really good piece of work in the summer, you can potentially develop it into a Europe grant later on, which is something larger that can happen with Ms. Valbuena Zanku. Like, she can help you with the Europe expansion. Some students start small and then it expands something bigger. Europe is one avenue. Sometimes you win a small research grant, you're a first year student or a sophomore, and you travel and you do this field work, and you're like, you know what, I actually want to do this for an honors thesis or for a certificate. So it can start with that and develop into something bigger. And I'll end with a kind of a similar note to Asma, in a sense where don't have this anxiety that this needs to be published the moment I think about it. You know, it's important to publish, yes, I do agree. And it's important to also diversify publications, not just academic publications, but now more than ever, we live in the world of the academic and the public persona. But also sometimes some research really is for your own intellectual development. Not everything I write, I publish, for instance. Even when it comes to fiction stuff, sometimes I choose, I think, you know what, this story is for me, not for others. So I think I'm really happy you mentioned that, because it's not everyone. I know we're a very competitive school and there's this pressure to always like publish. Sometimes it's good to take a break too and just do it for you.
No, thank you so much, MK, for highlighting all those opportunities and for specifying what you're looking for in an application, because there have been so many questions. I applied for this role, I thought it was this, but their application wasn't up to the mark. So I think the idea of making your application specific and then linking it to how it will help you in your academic journey, how in your intellectual journey, I think that's very important. And that will be greatly be beneficial for the listeners who are tuning in for this episode. Moving on to you, Asma, in your initial answer, I noticed that you mentioned a few key faculty members' names. So expanding on that, I want to understand that how did faculty mentorship play a role in your research endeavors at Georgetown? What was the help that you received from faculty mentorship? How did they guide you? How was the process like working with certain faculty members? And what importance do you give mentorship when it comes to individual research?
Yeah, I think that's an important question, but I don't want to overstress or understress both on mentorship. Of course, without mentorship, I would not be here. And of course, mentorship goes beyond the traditional roles of just teaching or just showing encouragement. Sometimes it's also somebody telling you that you're on the right track. So having said that, I of course think that with research, you do require a mentor, but it doesn't have to be somebody who guides you from step A to step Z. It can be somebody you have taken a class with and you found a research topic very interesting, and then you go up from there. So for example, for me, what was interesting, and I think it has been game changer, is that when I first came to Georgetown and I wanted to take a lot of classes in South Asia, professor, a historian of South Asia, Professor Peerbhai, was on a sabbatical and he was away for quite some time, and it was also pandemic and most of the things were shut down, so we couldn't see him or talk to him. And at that time, I pivoted towards Middle East because it was something I did not know a thing about. Mm-hmm. And from there, I got to know great professors like Professor Aryan, Professor Walter, Professor Sibeti, Professor Sonbol, of course, who I've worked with. And they sort of encouraged me to think about these questions deeply. I think mentorship starts in class, and then it goes to office hours, and from there it can go to something tangible or intangible. Mm. And I think I just was very consistent in what I wanted to pursue, and I really liked reading. So sometimes I think we forget that research can just begin in classroom if you do your reading correctly and on time. Yeah. Sometimes people discard the reading aspect and just come up with a really great project without knowing what has been said and what hasn't been said about a project. So I think from there on it developed. For our Reza J. Raines Fellowship, I think the reason why we went to Professor Chandra for his mentorship. And at that time, so this fellowship is very flexible. The mentor is not supposed to, be at your heads constantly. Mm-hmm. They just want a letter of recommendation from a mentor who can, of course, vouch for the applicability of this project and also say a few things about the two people who are applying. Mm-hmm. So in our case, Professor Chandra was the only professor both of us had taken. Mm-hmm. And he was, of course, an expert in migration in South Asia in that regard. We couldn't go to Miss Barber or Dr. Barber because we hadn't taken her as a professor. Yeah. We needed somebody who had been in charge of us pedagogically. And of course, he wrote a letter for us and we got the fellowship. And afterwards, he read the manuscript and he really liked it. As for my provost's fellowship and from there, my thesis, my mentor has been Professor Walter. And of course, beyond the fact that she's one of my favorite historians, she's also a person I'm really close to over the years. I took a class with her, America and the Muslim World, and I really, really was fascinated by the role of missionaries in colonial endeavors in the Middle East.
Yeah.
So it was a class specifically and totally designated for Middle East. And from there, I started thinking about missionaries in South Asia because I knew from my positionality of many mission schools and hospitals in Kashmir and generally in South Asia. And she was the one who was very insistent that I take up this idea. So she kept saying that, why don't you start thinking about missionaries in Kashmir? I kept delaying this question. I said, why don't I focus on missionaries in Punjab because there are more records there. And at one point she suggested, if you decide to do an honors thesis on this project, I would love to do a tutorial before the thesis project starts. And I was I was amazed by the fact that she wanted to do a tutorial, but the condition was that I had to do an honors in this in this field. And I did not want to work on missionaries because first, I thought there would not be any sources. Yeah. I wanted to work on more quote-unquote hip topic, like political topic, like nationalism and Hindutva politics in India. Thank God I didn't do that.
Yeah.
And then I decided to take up her offer and do a tutorial with her before my honors thesis tutorial began. So this was in junior year, which is, again, a great thing to think about. So you have an opportunity to take a class with professor one-on-one where you can develop a research project. And from there, we decided that there was, of course, a great literature on missionaries in Kashmir, which hadn't been explored. And from there, I told her that maybe this is a grant that I think I should apply so that I can go to the archives Because archives are essential in history, in traditional, quote-unquote, history, historical research. And then I applied to the grant and I got it. And from there, I developed my honors thesis proposal. So throughout it all, I think you need a professor who, of course, has enough expertise to tell you whether or not you're on the right track.
Yeah.
And these professors can be people you have taken classes with, which is great, but also professors you have no idea who have done work. So, for example, I know a friend of mine who's interested in education, conflict, and peace-building policies, and they took a tutorial with a philosopher, or somebody who's interested in philosophy of education. So, you know, you don't have to have those regional expertise. Like Professor Walter is not an expert on South Asia, but he's an expert on missionaries and empire.
Yeah.
So you need to have somebody who knows enough about this so they can guide you to look at certain avenues. Now Professor Walter sends me recommendations about certain things I can apply for. And these connections, you know, they span across different, different time. So I think we should think of mentorship openly. For example, I'm thinking of, MK mentioned that somebody is interested in documentary making, and we have a great documentary producer, Susie, at CIRS. So she's not like a direct professor you would work under, but she's somebody you can think of as a mentor.
As a mentor.
We have great people at the Writing Center. We have great faculty in language department. So I think picking up on these things and thinking of mentor, not as a traditional professor with a PhD degree, but also somebody who has experience and expertise in niche areas, is also a way we can think about mentorship.
Oh, definitely. Thank you, Asma, for that. I definitely agree with that. I feel like attending a class, like your relationship with your professor goes beyond the classroom when it comes to having tutorials with them, when it comes to them helping you in your research. And it's Georgetown's great with this. All the professors that I've asked for help when it comes to research endeavors have really gone out of their way to help me as well. So I think that's great. Moving on to you, MK. So this is a bit on a more of a personal element. You were, before this position, you were the assistant director in admissions, right? And now you've been shifted to the assistant director of student research, which is a newly found office. So firstly, how has your experience been so far with this shift? And how is it like now? How is the new office different than the other one?
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, what strategies and initiatives do you want? Because you're in a new position in a new place, you'd probably want something new to come about it. So what strategies and initiatives do you have in your mind that you want to implement in Georgetown in the coming years?
Those are all really good questions. I'll start by saying, in terms of the admissions, this is more like a sartorial comment, but the change of offices is good and bad. Now I'm on the first floor, so it's easier for students to find me. Before, in admissions, I think if you're not really coming there for an application, you don't go to the ground floor as much. But I do miss the Oxygen Park view. So right now I overlook the Damien Hirst baby statues outside Sidra and the highway. So it's meditative in its own way. Interestingly enough, when I was in admissions, I was overseeing international recruitment, mainly international students.
Yeah.
Because when I came back to Georgetown, I really wanted to promote our campus more.
Yeah.
Because of that community aspect that Asma mentioned, even at Harvard, like, it was a great school intellectually, but the community mode, let's say, was never as strong as GUQ in terms of the mentorship, the friendships, the exposure you get at an early age. So I saw admissions as a way to kind of re-engage with the community in that way, to travel and promote our university. There's a lot of research that was involved in that. You have to identify different geographies, different students from around the world, from varied backgrounds. You have to identify these kind of schools that you're targeting, why you're targeting them. You have to also internally figure out how you're promoting your campus. What are you talking about from a student experience? When you're in an admissions office, most of your research revolves around student life in a way.
Yeah.
Because you're mostly talking to students and parents and counselors. And counselors sometimes are like professional parents. So the language you're detailing and coming up with is very much oriented towards, okay, what is the modern student? What is the Georgetown student? What kind of students are we looking for from around the world to come and join us here? And we also did a lot of fun creative research with two students. So I'll give them a shout out, Sia Hadibi and John Owutu. A lot of amazing social media stuff.
The Desert Hoya.
Desert Hoya. Yeah.
So that was definitely amazing.
So that was really fun. That was a benefit in a weird way of the pandemic, because we stopped traveling, because before I was away from the office for so long on different flights, like in different countries. So this was a way to engage again. So that transition was a bit smooth in a sense. Sorry, my headphones always fall even if I'm going for a walk. I think my ears. So basically, that transition was smooth, but obviously being in a student research office, the main difference is you're working with current students again.
Yeah.
Admissions is more retrospective and future. You're working with high school students, imagining them becoming Georgetown students. Mm. In student research, you're working with directly again with students on the ground.
Yeah.
So it's different. Kind of relates to what Asma talked about, like the present and the past.
So
a lot of it in the beginning was setting up new systems. I mean, Georgetown always cared about research, but we still hadn't had the clarity on the funding. What I wanted to do is move things into forms, change the layout, talk to students more, do more lunch and learns in the beginning. And we're really happy to see the uptake. I mean, the number of applications is quite high.
Yeah.
So in the beginning, of course, the first month, it was a bit slow because students were getting reintroduced the idea that there's direct funding now for student research.
Yeah.
So my first goal was to talk to people again.
Yeah.
Before, because you can't imagine people just to apply if there's no connection.
Yeah.
So I actually had met with Asma in the fall to talk about her experience as a student, because in the past, what was happening is a lot of kind of diligent students who were proactive, they would find research opportunities on their own through the main campus. So it was important to kind of talk about that experience as well, to see, to compare.
Yeah.
And then now, a lot of it is a mixture of mentorship, spreading the word, about research meetings with students directly in my office to discuss ideas. Okay, how can we narrow it down before they apply, especially when it comes to the student research part? So office hours are important. I'm usually in my office, but I also recommend emailing me to kind of book an appointment. That way I can dedicate more time.
Exactly.
In terms of the longer goals, one thing I'd like to see is a research open house that happens early on in the semester.
That'd be great.
So, you know, like how Student Life does SAC Fair.
Yeah.
We have these. I think if we have research open house in the atrium or whatever location, the library, and we have different tables, and the students can come to talk to us maybe in September and the fall semester, it would make it easier for people to notice this. Not everyone reads the email that there's an announcement or whatever.
Can I add something to that? I think I have an idea. So what you could do is also, so I'm thinking that most of the students must have taken the grants for the summer research, and the fall is when they come back, and this
of
is
course.
The time when a lot of freshmen are also coming in. Along with an open house, you could also have like a open presentation with everybody talking about what they did, and then you could open the cycle again so that students know that this is what other people have done, and this is what I can also
definitely do. So that's going to be part of it for sure, like having students come back and talk either through a lunch and learn format or a presentation. And even the students who traveled right now on conferences, part of the kind of giving back to the community was an expectation to give us direct feedback and then sign up for a slot in the fall to discuss that. Another idea is basically to have regular workshops, hopefully in coordination with the Writing Center, when a proposal, when an email reminder is sent.
Yeah.
Let's say, oh, applications are due for Student Experience Fund or for Student Research. Maybe we can do a workshop simultaneously with the Writing Center to say, okay, what makes a good proposal?
Yeah, that'll be
great. Things like that to align it more strategically that way. I definitely want to do more publishing mentorship. We're still brainstorming that, and that's going to happen over the summer. Because right now the emphasis was getting all these applications out and working with the students. Summer is more the creative period where you can kind of engage in a different way. So we're going to be hopefully launching some publishing avenues by the fall. Right now we have, in my office, I have three student workers.
Yeah.
An editorial fellow and two museums researcher.
Yeah.
So the editorial fellow has been training in doing interviews and writing op-eds, think pieces, looking creatively at the intersection of politics and culture in particular. Museums researchers are basically because more than ever, we have direct collaboration with Qatar museums.
Yeah.
And I used to work a lot in the arts. I still do, but not as much. And basically, these students are identifying themes with all the museums that operate in Doha and seeing how we can tie what they're sitting in the liberal arts with that exhibition. So we have we have one student who's writing about a sculpture in Mathaf, the Museum of Modern Art Arab art in Education City, and a very fascinating discovery that she's found out. I won't reveal it now because she's actually still writing it, but she discovered this big kind of archival element there, and she's kind of synthesizing it into an article. We have another student who is training in reviewing exhibitions. Sometimes they're writing about political cinema. So we're trying to experiment right now with all these creative ventures to see what works for the students and take it from there.
Well, that's amazing. It's amazing to hear about all these initiatives, and I think they'll be really beneficial for the students, especially the freshmen and sophomores who are looking to indulge themselves into the journey of research. But you mentioned about these creative elements as well, and it's really interesting to see that research isn't like it's Georgetown's focusing on not just the traditional research ways, but looking at other creative ways. And that gets me thinking, because you yourself have published a number of influential short stories that weave into the narratives of exploring themes of identity, belonging, and the nuances of Middle Eastern life, right? And each story offers a window into diverse experiences and settings. My question is essentially, how has this storytelling become a medium for you to convey deeper reflections on societal narratives, whether it's societal narratives or cultural identities and shared human experiences across borders and history?
Mm-hmm. That's a very, very good question, actually. And I think every researcher is a storyteller. Yeah. Even if you're an economics student, and this is not a diss.
It is, really.
It's a diss to two economics students sitting here.
Like, if you had come to, anyone who's come to the honors theses, you'd see the passion that the students have after spending a year researching something, whether it's from a data lens or from a fieldwork lens or from, like, a realpolitik lens, there's always a storytelling element. I think for me, I'll just give you a very brief background why I had moved into fiction. When I was doing my master's in Middle Eastern studies, I was writing my thesis on architecture and escapism in Beirut. And I had traveled for fieldwork as well, but simultaneously I was taking fiction courses at Harvard with this professor called Laura Vandenberg, who is an amazing author. I'd really recommend to check out her work if you have time. And the nice part about that master's is that every semester it allowed me one course outside of my area of focus. So that my second year I had chosen the literature path, particularly writing fiction, which was very interesting model. Basically, the way it works is that you apply through a fellowship and you're accepted into a 12-seater round table, and every week you have to produce a short story and everyone reads it.
Cool.
It was very intense, but it was a good kind of intense to kind of break out of your shell in a way. And so I realized that I was really loving the fiction writing a bit more than my academic writing. I loved that a lot too, and I loved the thesis that I wrote back then. But the fiction one allowed me to talk to a new audience beyond kind of the elite academic audience in a way. However, you identified something important, and a lot of my short stories, it's cultural commentary. And I would say it's more like ethnographic fiction. I studied Kalp and then I did anthropology. So a lot of the fiction, there's a deep focus on details, on interactions between people, on society, on architecture. So a lot of the training I had here as a student and in my master's still appears in my fiction, but now with a new language. So it's a different kind of form. A lot of it tends to take place during important political episodes that I saw as a kid in Beirut, but usually those episodes are in the background. And so it's storytelling, it's a bit of ethnography, it's a bit of research. Every short story, there's research before as well in terms of why am I writing this and who are the characters, what are they involved in. But it's a haphazard form of research. It's not traditional in a sense, like where it follows a chronology or an archaeology.
On this discussion of storytelling, Asma, how do you see your own experiences and academic achievements, particularly your Rhodes Scholarship, preparing you for the next steps in your academic and professional journey? And how does this recognition empower you to influence the narratives around your field of study?
Yeah, that's a very heavy question. I think something they would have asked me at the final interview, but a very important one as well. So I think I think it's time I talk about this in more depth. So for Rhodes, I had to write two essays. One is a personal statement, and second is a academic statement. So academic statement is more about the course you're interested, why you, and what next, basically. And the personal statement asks you to answer three questions. And it's very open-ended, but it has to answer those three questions. Which Rhodes quality do you think you have? Why do you want to apply to Rhodes? And like, you know, what next kind of things? And in my, so I first wrote my academics, first I started with a CV and second I started with an academic statement. And in my personal statement, I realized that my topic of interest or history is not separate from who I see myself as. Mm. And the thing I'm interested in academically is something I'm also interested in personally, and that is my story. And it is at that moment that I think I became sort of cognizant of the fact that the reason why this project matters is only because of who is seeing this story. Mm. Sometimes we forget that we have certain powers and privileges that other people might not have, what we call in history positionality or lived experiences. So I used to talk about this a lot in my classes, but it is only until I realized when I was applying for Rhodes that my voice, my work matters because of my positionality.
Yeah.
And the story that I want to tell through Mission Archives is probably more academic than personal.
Yeah.
But if you look at it, if you look at the journey that I've taken to come at this conclusion, is very personal. The reason why I'm interested in missionaries or mission archives is probably because I think accessing political archives in Kashmir is a very hard thing to do. It comes with a lot of state scrutiny. It comes with a lot of tensions that you have to face, given the fact that your family is going to be in Kashmir and they might face a lot of repercussions because of what you want to write about or read about. Even publishing something about Kashmir comes with a lot of opportunity costs. My attempt to look at alternative archives was a means to center people's lived experiences or people's voices in the story. I was interested in specific caste groups in Kashmir mm-hmm. that have never been written about in any historical works. I was interested in a time period which has only been looked into through political lens and not cultural lens or not religious lens or not ethnographic lens, and see what are the things we can do. And from there, I realized that the problem is that we don't have alternative archives about Kashmir or any other place which is considered to be a contested territory. So archives are a place where you have a depository of stories.
Yeah.
And it is from there that I realized that photographs, obituaries, family albums, oral histories are things we can collect from Kashmir but also around the world, which can create a data set for other historians or other scholars to tap on. And I'm, of course, very lucky and privileged to have gotten this scholarship. But I don't think you need a scholarship as prestigious or as old, as contested as Rhodes to tell you that your voices matter or that your story matters. So I think beyond scholarships, beyond graduate school applications or job opportunities, once you know and you realize that you're interested in X and Y, and X and Y might not lead to the results that are considered quote-unquote profitable, but you still have a sense of duty, responsibility, and passion towards the thing, you should definitely follow it.
Mm.
History is not a very lucrative field. Academia is not a very lucrative field. And I don't think anybody should be pushed into it. But if you know that there's a subject that intrigues you and you want to follow that passion, it can be economics, it can be data, it can be anything, it can be photography, it can be documentary. Your input values is valuable, and your story matters is something I realized throughout my application project. But it would not have been possible without this 4 years journey that I have taken at Georgetown. In fact, I think one of the questions at my interview at Rhodes after an hour-long conversation was that, do you think you would be able to make an application as strong as this had you not gone to Georgetown? Of course, I had to say no, because they were all Indians in front of me. But the answer is yes. I don't think I would have been able to make a strong application as I did for Rhodes had I not come to Georgetown, had I not received, and of course, Abdullah and Ibrahim have not paid me to say this, had I not received the mentorship I received from my professors, the opportunities, and a sense of community. Sometimes we forget that the fact that it's a very small campus is something we should leverage for our advantage.
Exactly.
We know a lot of people who have great mm-hmm. skills. We can tap on them and like do creative and collaborative works like this broadcast.
Exactly.
We can meet professors in a very small atmosphere and a class where we can have one-on-one discussions with them. We have different experts from all around the world, but with a different care of positionality, like professors who have studied at Ivy Leagues and Oxbridge, but also have a deep sense of appreciation for the mm-hmm. place that they are in. So that is something I think we should all capitalize on. And hopefully that answers it.
Yeah, definitely it does. So I wish you all the best for the future, Asma. And in the end, I think we're over time. So to wrap it up, in the end, I would like to thank both of you, MK and Asma, for your time. And thank you everyone who's listening for tuning in. I hope you all find this episode to be helpful. We encourage you to share this episode with your friends so that they benefit from these opportunities that were highlighted. And please do not forget to follow us on our Instagram page @GUQ_speaks so that you can remain updated on all our new episodes that come out. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Abdullah.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of GUQ Speaks. We hope you've gained valuable insights and inspirations from our conversation today. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to follow us on our Instagram page at GUQ_speaks, and be sure to leave a review on Spotify to show your support.